Are you too warm, anyone? I see you taking off your coat. Pretty warm. We better see if the custodian can get us some fresh air without the heat. Part of it, if you will, please, Jim. Anybody? Then, is there someone here that can open some doors or... All right, turn in your Bibles to John 4. We're going to be continuing in this study on worship. We noticed last week that for the Christian, all of his life is worship. There are no secular, in contrast to sacred, areas of his life. There is no sacred that really excludes the secular. For the Christian, it's all a life of worship to God. And once we find our God-ordained, God-approved roles in life, then as we begin to function in those roles, living in love, living in service, then our entire life becomes one great anthem of praise. It becomes a living sacrifice. We become aroma that ever is offering itself up into the nostrils of God as worship and adoration. So when we're at work, we're worshiping. When we're at play, we're worshiping. When we study, we're worshiping. When we are assembled in an occasion like this, we're worshiping. Before we began this hour, as you sang that great hymn of praise, you were worshiping. You weren't singing before we began worship. You were worshiping before we began whatever. You were worshiping. The whole thing is worship. And so we find that great realization that adds new zest to our lives. It adds new meaning to changing the baby's diapers, because that's worship. It adds new meaning to the wife and mother who stays at home and raises those children to know the Lord. That's worship. It gives new impetus, gives new zing. It gives just simply a whole new perspective to the life of the Christian. Now, turn to verse 22. Jesus here says, "You worship what you do not know. We worship what we know, for salvation is of the Jews." This sounds almost like the Apostle Paul in Acts the 17th chapter when he was in Athens. He was there addressing the people of Athens and said, "As I passed along and observed the objects of your worship, I found an altar with this inscription, 'To an unknown God.' What therefore you worship as unknown, this I proclaim to you. The God who made the world and everything in it, being Lord of heaven and earth, does not live in shrines made by man, nor is he served by human hands as though he needed anything, since he himself gives to all men life and breath and everything." It sounds like Paul was addressing the same issue that Jesus was addressing here to the Samaritan woman, which leads us to the conclusion that it was not just the Samaritans who worshipped ignorantly. It was virtually the whole world worshipping ignorantly. And as I look at my own life as a Christian, the earlier years of my life, and I think I speak also for you, they were spent in ignorant worship. I really didn't know whom it was I was worshiping. Once I discovered the personality and the nature of the one whom I was worshiping, I quit trying to worship. I used to try. Man, I would just work at it. I would try to worship. I don't try anymore because I've learned whom it is I'm worshiping, and he is so beautiful to me that every time I think of him, my heart just opens and bursts with a song of praise and thanksgiving. I no longer have to try to worship. And so we find, though, that as a result of ignorance, most of the world was, at the time of Christ and the time of Paul, worshiping at altars of unknown gods. And that rather than being the exception, this was actually the rule. Jesus said, "What you worship, you know not what. We worship what we know, for salvation is of the Jews." And after discussing or declaring in verse 21... that the hour was coming when neither in this mountain, that is in Mount Gerizim, nor in Jerusalem would men worship God. After declaring that and stating that there's a new hour coming, a new age is dawning, that there is a new perspective on the horizon. And he says later on that that horizon is already in the present tense. The hour is coming and now is. So Jesus was the pioneer who was announcing to the world a whole new concept. After making this statement that it would no longer be confined to Jerusalem or Gerizim, then Jesus returns to the point that the woman herself had brought up. And having settled that, he goes to this simple proclamation here that the Jews worshipped what they knew the Gentiles or the Samaritans did not. For salvation is of the Jews. And he comes home to this one simple cold fact that not all that is offered to God as worship is acceptable. Not all is intelligent. Not all is meaningful or acceptable. That there is ignorant worship. God has never allowed people to worship any way they pleased. And Jesus here acknowledges that. Not all worship is acceptable. And as it was brought down to the immediate conflict between the Jews and the Samaritans, Jesus took his side and took his stand on the side of the Jews. He said, salvation is of the Jews. Salvation, he places here, is as the result of revelation. True worship is the result of revelation. Worship is not just man reaching up to God. Enlightened worship is God reaching down to man, revealing himself to him, and then in a way that is logical, in a way that is reasonable and rational, man responds in an emotional, rational, reasonable response of adoration, but that comes through revelation. And so Jesus here places himself on the side of revelation, saying simply, you can't just blunder around and expect to be pleasing to God. Salvation comes from the Jews. Then Jesus returns now to the grand theme that he's discussing in verse 23. But the hour is coming, and now is, when the true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and in truth, for such the Father seeks to worship him. Whereas the discussion about right worship might heretofore have been settled by settling the question of whether it was Jerusalem or Gerizim, that no longer is true. The question doesn't reside, the answer doesn't reside there. The question is no longer seated in such a discussion about geographical location. He says the hour is coming when neither in this mountain nor in Jerusalem will men worship God. The hour is coming and now is when the true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and in truth. What did he mean by that? He says, obviously, that the question does not reside in such mundane things as geographical location. That's not what's going to discover or determine true worship. He said true worship is going to be determined by these two qualities. Those true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and in truth. What did he mean? Ordinarily, and I say ordinarily, it has seemed to be the custom that we interpret these two qualifications or these two characteristics of true worship, we interpret them like this, that in spirit means that the true worshipers will worship God sincerely, and that in truth means that they will worship God according to His revealed word. Now that has been the normal, I would say the normal interpretation by brethren throughout the last century, or the last 50 years. I don't have enough information to pinpoint it, but I think that you'll agree and you'll corroborate this conclusion that that's pretty well exhausted our interpretation of this particular passage. And though that's true, though it's true that the true worshipers will worship God sincerely and they will worship God according to God's revealed will, that's not really what Jesus was talking about here. At least it doesn't exhaust what he's saying. Jesus had something else in mind. You see, God has always required worshipers of Him to worship Him sincerely. That's nothing new. He's always required worshipers to worship according to what He's revealed. That's nothing new. So when you consider the fact that Jesus, in verse 22, Jesus indicated that these things were underlying what He was saying. That they were worshiping, the Gentiles or the Samaritans were worshiping in ignorance. The Jews were worshiping God according to what they knew. But then he's saying, now I'm going to show you a new way that is in addition to both the Jewish method and the Samaritan method. I'm going to introduce you to a new system of worship. So he couldn't have been talking about the sincerity part of it, nor the worshiping according to God's revealed will. He had already admitted that that was characteristic of the Jews' worship. They worshiped God with their knowledge. They knew what they were worshiping. And they worshiped God in the proper place, as we'll notice in just a moment. Jesus was introducing a whole new system of worship. He was introducing, and I don't even like to use the word system, though there's nothing wrong with that, but he was introducing a new concept. Something for which the Gentiles or the Samaritans or the Jews did not have a category for. And so he was introducing something here that was a new mental category, and it took some doing in order to get it across. He was not just putting new wine in old wineskins. Had he been coming to say that what I've come to do is to make sure that you people worship sincerely and that you worship according to the revealed will of God, it would have been tantamount to putting new wine in old wineskins. Jesus said, I didn't come to do that. He said, I did not come to put new patches on old garments. But he said, in essence, I've come to give you an entirely new wineskin, a new content, a new container, as well as a new content, and also I've come to give you a brand new garment, not just one that's been patched up. So obviously, he's saying that he has come to change the whole concept of worship. Now, having said all of that, what is he saying? What is he talking about? You and I must discern, we must discover, what is this very heart issue as it relates to our relationship to God. This is one of the key issues that we must not misunderstand. And if we do misunderstand it, we're going to rob ourselves of the fullness of life that Jesus promised to bring us when he came and said, I have come that they might have life and have it more abundantly. There's a key factor involved. The key factor that we must understand if we're going to grasp this new concept is that the worship of both the Jews and the Samaritans, and for that matter, the bulk of the whole world, that the worship that those people engaged in all down through the centuries had been characterized by two qualities. One of these is that the worship of both Jew and Samaritan and Gentile had been physical in substance and had been symbolic in nature. Now, these two qualities characterized the worship both of Jew and Samaritan at the time that Jesus lived. The old system of worship was physical in content or in substance and symbolic in nature. What do you mean by physical in substance? Well, the woman here at the well, she was looking for the right place to go and worship. Her concept did not go beyond. That was what she was concerned about. There was an argument as to whether or not it was in Gerizim or in Jerusalem. Her concept of worship was tied to a place. It's this that Jesus says, wait a minute, the hour is coming when neither in this place or in that place men will worship God. Not ruling out those places, but just simply saying that it will not be determined by geographical boundaries. You can't limit it to one geographical location in contrast and in exclusion to another. So her concept was, it was physical in substance. She was looking for the right place. And under the old law, the right place was Jerusalem. If you're looking for the proper answer, this is what Jesus meant when he said that you don't know what you're worshiping. They were worshiping up in Samaria, at Mount Gerizim. God never had authorized worship to be there. Turn to Deuteronomy, the 12th chapter, and let's look here briefly. We don't want to spend much time here, but I do want to look at verse 5 of Deuteronomy 12. This, and also we're going to turn to 2 Chronicles, the 7th chapter. Deuteronomy 12:5 says, you shall, I'll wait till you get there, because this explains it in detail. But you shall seek the place which the Lord your God will choose out of all your tribes to put his name and make his habitation there. Thither you shall go, and thither you shall bring your burnt offerings, your sacrifices, your tithes and offerings that you present, your votive offerings, your freewill offerings, and the firstlings of your herd and of your flock. And there you shall eat before the Lord your God, and you shall rejoice, you and your households, in all that you undertake, in which the Lord your God has blessed you. You shall not do according to all that you are doing here this day, every man doing whatever is right in his own eyes, for you have not as yet come into the rest and into the inheritance which the Lord your God gives you. But when you go over this Jordan and live in the land which the Lord your God gives you to inherit, and when he gives you rest from all your enemies round about, so that you live in safety, then to the place which the Lord your God will choose to make his name dwell there, thither you shall bring all that I command you. And he lists all those things again. Look again now at 2 Chronicles chapter 7. And he names the city, or I believe he does, else if he doesn't name it, it's implied because Solomon is standing in the city, in the temple. In 2 Chronicles chapter 7 and verse 12, no, the city is not mentioned here, but Solomon had just finished praying to God. And after Solomon's prayer, God responds. Verse 12 says, "Then the Lord appeared to Solomon in the night and said to him, 'I've heard your prayer and have chosen this place for myself as a house of sacrifice.'" This place, what? Jerusalem. That's where his name was recorded. That's where he stipulated that all worship of that nature should occur, and that people would come into that location and bring their votive offerings, their sacrifices, their burnt offerings. All of these offerings were to be offered there in the temple in Jerusalem on top of Mount Zion, not on Gerizim. So as far as there being a right or wrong during the old system, there's no question about where the right was. That's why Jesus says, "You Samaritans don't know what you're worshiping." The Jews do, because salvation has come from the Jews. But now the question is this. You might wonder why in the world it was ever physical to begin with. Why did God ever have a system that arranged a worship that would bring people together in one locality? Why did he do it? If it was ineffective, if it really was insufficient, and if it was not complete, why did he ever do it in the first place? Well, I'll have to speculate, but I can't help but believe that it had something to do with the preservation of the Jewish nation as the repository of the people and as the repository of the revelation that would bring about the coming of the Christ. I can't help but believe that it had to do with that. You see, since the Jewish nation was a theocracy, and that means that it was as much religious as it was political, and their political laws were actually their religious laws, and the thing so interlapped and overlapped and was interwoven together, they were called a theocracy. And so the preservation of nationalism was essential to the preservation of their religion. And you brought the two together, and it became feasible to bring all of this together into one locality and to promote and propagate and preserve the unity that the annual feasts would bring about as the whole nation there was brought together into one locality. There would be a homecoming every year for the Jewish nation that would help them preserve their national identity. But the new worship is not like that. Jesus said it's not going to be like that anymore. Neither in Jerusalem nor in Mount Gerizim. There's a whole new order on the horizon. There's a whole new order just around the corner. In fact, it's already here. When something else is going to take over. The new worship was not national. It is international. That's right. It's universal. Consequently, a central meeting place that gave special attention to a locality, a geographical locality, was not feasible. How in the world could they, just talking about in matters of practicalities, how could you bring a whole world from all corners of the earth, how could you bring them back to the city of Jerusalem? So it wasn't feasible. And then secondly, it wasn't desirable, because that particular kind of worshiping, that particular kind of framework had served its purpose and was no longer in force. It was no longer in vogue. It was obsolete and no longer had a place. But not only was it physical in its substance, it was symbolic in nature. The worship of the Jews and the worship of the Samaritans and the worship of those heathen nations, they had their sacrifices, they had their blood baths, they would stand you under a grating and put a cow up above you and slit its throat, and you would bathe in that blood and actually become soaked in the blood of that cow or sheep. But all of this, even the false premature or the false or immature religions of the heathen, that was symbolic. The Samaritans' offerings and all were symbolic. The Jew, as it was revealed by God, was symbolic. Whatever cleansing there was in those sacrifices was symbolic. It didn't have to do with the real thing itself. Turn over to Hebrews, the 10th chapter, and let's look there quickly. Hebrews 10, 1 through 4. The first verse of that 10th chapter talks about these offerings and how that they were purely symbolic. For since the law has but a shadow of the good things to come instead of the true form of these realities, it can never, by the same sacrifices which are continually offered year after year, make perfect those who draw near. Otherwise, would they not have ceased to be offered? If the worshippers had once been cleansed, they would no longer have any consciousness of sin. But in these sacrifices, there is a reminder of sin year after year. For it is impossible that the blood of bulls and goats should take away sin. So, you see, all of this was symbolic, and there's much more information in the book of Hebrews that talks about the symbolic nature of these sacrifices, that they were not the true, they were not the real, they were merely symbolic in nature. And whereas in that age the symbolic was what reigned, today the real is what reigns. And when we say that theirs was symbolic in nature, then the opposite of that is that ours is not symbolic, it's the real thing, it's the genuine, it's the true. Well, you might ask again, why did God ever give a symbolic worship? Why? What was the point? Why did God ever set up a system that was symbolic in nature? Here again, let me speculate, but I think you'll find it's true. In bringing the human race away from that worship of the physical, the immediate, the visible, in bringing the human race away from that kind of worship, and that's what the world was engaged in, the worshiping of things that could be touched, the things that were actually in opposition to God, in bringing them away from that kind of worship of the physical and of the present, the temporal, and bringing them all the way to the worship of the eternal God in truth and in spirit, there was necessarily involved a halfway house. Now that's the best way I know how to describe the function of the Jewish economy in terms of the worship system, the worship activity of human beings. It provided a halfway house until God could get us away from the worshiping of mammon and the worshiping of things that we could make with our hands and bow down before idols and rocks and stumps and stones. In getting us away from that and bringing us back to the eternal, the worship of the eternal, spiritual, heavenly one, it was necessary for Him to put a stepping stone to get us on from one bank across this river to another, this stepping stone to help us as a halfway house. That's what Judaism provided. But whatever, that old system was now and is now obsolete. Look at chapter 8 of Hebrews and verse 13. In speaking of a new covenant, he treats the first as obsolete. Whatever may have been the reason for him having that which was symbolic in nature, he says it's now obsolete. And what is becoming obsolete and growing old is ready to vanish away. So we find that if you'll look at these two basic pillars that characterize the worship both of Jew and Gentile, Jew and Samaritan, or Samaritan, we find that what characterized their worship was that it was physical in substance. She was looking for the right place. It was limited by geographical location, physical in substance, and it was also symbolic in its nature. That which Jesus is talking about, then, as he says, the hour is coming when that's not going to be what characterizes true worship. The true worshipers will worship in a way that is not physical in its substance, and it is not symbolic in its nature. But it is instead, it is real, it is in spirit, or it is in spirit, and it's real. He goes on to say the reason why in verse 23 of that chapter 4. Verse 24 it is of John 4. Look again now as he talks not only about what will be. The hour is coming and now is when the true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and in truth. For such the Father seeks to worship Him. He says that's what's coming. Now in verse 24, he tells why it is that it's going to be. He says it's because God is Spirit. God is Spirit. And those that worship Him will know. Those that worship Him must worship in spirit and in truth. So he says the hour is coming when the true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and truth. That's just a statement of fact. He said that's coming. And then in verse 24, he says, this is why they will, and this is why they must. He said, it's because God Himself is Spirit. And those that worship don't have any choice. Those that worship must worship in spirit and in truth. Therefore, the time is coming, he says, when the worship union between the created and the creator, when the worship union will no longer be physical, it will no longer be symbolic, it will be the actual and the true, and it must be conducted on the nature of the plane of the one who is being worshipped. And since he says that God is spirit, he says all true worship then will have to be conducted in that kind of currency. If you go overseas to visit, when you enter their country, you change all of your currency into their currency. As we now approach the eternal, as we approach the spiritual, as we approach the God who himself is spirit, and we come into his presence, we do somewhat the same way. We change all of our earthly currency into the spiritual and deal with him on the currency that characterizes his own existence. And that's about as simple an illustration as I know how to give. He simply says that God is spirit, and those that worship him must worship on the plane that characterizes the one who is worshipped, and that is in spirit. Look quickly now at these verses. Look over at Romans 1 and verse 9. And these perhaps are not, they're very simple verses that we'll just go at and look at quickly. For God is my witness, whom I serve with my spirit in the gospel of his Son. Look at Ephesians 6:18 quickly. Ephesians 6:18 says, pray at all times in the Spirit. Pray at all times in the Spirit with all prayer and supplication. Look at Philippians, the next chapter, or the next book, 3:3. For we are the true circumcision who worship God in spirit. There it is. We are the true circumcision who worship God in spirit and glory in Jesus Christ and put no confidence in the flesh. Look at 1 Thessalonians 5:16. 16 and 17. Rejoice always, pray constantly, give thanks in all circumstances, for this is the will of God in Christ Jesus for you. He talks there about just simply a constant prayer. Pray constantly, as one translation says, or many said, pray without ceasing. In everything and in all circumstances, give thanks. Now, he didn't just say in some of them, but in everything. So our worship to God must be in spirit. Why? Because God is spirit. And then it also must be in truth. It must be in reality. The new worship would no longer be through symbols. Now, the Jewish worship was, they had a temple, physical temple. They had a holy place in that physical temple. They had a curtain that separated it from the outer temple or the outer court, which was representative of life itself. And there were all these symbolic things, these priests and the sacrifices and the incense and the temple and all of this. But no longer. We don't have that today. We don't have to go to a location. We don't have to go through certain symbols in order to perform our worship before God. We simply offer it as the in the realm of the real. Look at Hebrews, the 8th chapter and verse 5. Hebrews 8 and verse 5. He says here that they serve a copy and a shadow of the heavenly sanctuary. They serve a copy of it and a shadow of the heavenly. Not the real thing. Talking about the Jewish economy, they served a copy and a shadow. Not the real thing. Remember what happened in Matthew, in the death of Jesus, recorded in Matthew? You remember about when Jesus died, the veil of the temple, what happened to it? It was ripped in two, exposing all of this that had been hidden for 1,000 years. 1,400 years, perhaps, if you go back into the time of the tabernacle. This had been hidden from human view. It was ripped down apart from top to bottom and exposed to the obscene gaze, if you please, of the entire Jewish nation. There they could stare at the holy place, the Holy of Holies. But that was symbolic of what happened when Jesus died. Through his flesh, the veil of the temple was torn apart. And we see now what the Jewish people could not see. We are actually entered into and ushered into the realm of the real, where the Jew was always confined to the realm of the symbolic. Their sacrifices, their prayers, these things were accompanied by the symbolic. No longer is that true today. We actually live in the realm of the real. And we ought not to be content with the shadow. Who wants to eat a shadow of a ham sandwich? Not I. Now that's what he was saying. He's saying you've been living off the shadow. He said the Christian lives off of the ham sandwich, and that's the difference. And I'm not content to dwell in the shadows while the ham sandwich is around. In Hebrews 4:14, Paul says there that we have a high priest, Jesus Christ, who has entered into the heavens. We're going to just notice a few more verses in Hebrews, and then the lesson is yours. Hebrews 4:14, he says, since we have a great high priest who has passed through the heavens, Jesus the Son of God, let's hold fast to our confession. Then in Hebrews the 8th chapter, verses 1 and 2 and 5 again. Now the point of what we're saying is this. We have such a high priest who is seated at the right hand of the throne of the majesty in heaven, a minister in the sanctuary and the true tent, which is set up not by men, but by the Lord. And then verse 5, they, that is the Jews, serve a copy and shadow of the heavenly sanctuary. But then look over in chapter 9 and verse 8 and verse 9 beginning. When he talks about they serve a copy and shadow, he says in verse 9 of chapter 9, which is symbolic for the present age. Now the word symbolic here comes from the word, as Brother Bales points out in an article, that it comes from the word parable. Parabole. It was a parable. What was the purpose of the old Jewish economy and the worship that they engaged in? It was a parable. It was something that contained the truth. It was thrown alongside of another one in order to get them ready for the reality, but it was a parable. It was a figure. It was a type, and not the thing itself, which is symbolic for the present age. According to this arrangement, gifts and sacrifices are offered which cannot perfect the conscience of the worshiper, but deal only with food and drink and various ablutions, regulations for the body imposed until the time of Reformation. But when Christ appeared as a high priest of the good things that have come, then through the greater and more perfect tent, not made with hands, that is, not of this creation, he entered once for all into the holy place, taking not the blood of goats and calves, but his own blood, thus securing an eternal redemption. In other words, he was no longer dealing in things that were temporal and were symbolic. In fact, the writer of Hebrews says, had he been involved on earth as a priest, he wouldn't be a priest at all, because he was of the tribe of Judah, and no priest ever came from the tribe of Judah. It was always from the tribe of Levi. But he said, since the fact that he doesn't serve on earth, he serves in a new heaven, in a new realm. He serves in the heavenly tabernacle, pitched not by men's hands, but by God. There is where he functions as the eternal priest after the order of Melchizedek. And all these are terms that are not familiar to us as Jews. They're not familiar to us as Gentiles. They are familiar to people as Jews, but we have adopted them, and they are familiar enough to you as a Gentile that you can understand what he's talking about. Well, let's not be content with the shadow or the copy. Now, do you see what he's talking about when he says that the new worship is not going to be determined by whether it's in Gerizim or in Jerusalem? That's not what it doesn't involve that. He says the new worship is going to be determined. The true worshipers will worship God in spirit and in truth. For God is spirit, and those that worship him must worship in spirit and in truth. It'll no longer be physical in its substance. It will no longer be what? Symbolic in its nature, no longer physical, no longer symbolic, but spiritual and real. Now, how does that affect us? Well, it just simply means that we're no longer restricted to locale. Our worship is conducted before God day and night. What is the temple? It's our body in one respect. What's the holy place or the temple? It's our body, but in the sense that it's our life, lived wherever it is. And in our body, Paul told the Corinthians, God's Spirit dwells. And in our body, we as priests serve that Spirit. We are the priests, God is the indwelling one, and our bodies or our lives are the sanctuary or the holy place of this new religion, this new worship. And when you've got a priest and a holy place God living in this temple, then you've got worship. That's why Paul could say that we ought to present our bodies as living sacrifices, holy and acceptable to God, which is your reasonable worship. And we'll get to that discussion later on. Turn to one other verse as we close. To Colossians, the third chapter, the second chapter. He talks about how Christ did away, up in verse 14, he canceled the bond which stood against the Jew with its legal demands. He set it aside, nailing it to the cross. He disarmed the principalities and powers, made a public example of them, triumphing over them in him. Verse 16 there says, therefore let no one pass judgment on you in question of food and drink or with regard to a festival or a new moon or Sabbath. These are only a shadow of what is to come, but the substance belongs to Christ. And the King James here has the body belongs to Christ. He's not talking about the body of the church there. He's talking about the contrast between the shadow and the reality. The shadow, he said, these things, the restrictions on food and feast days and new moons and all of this that the Jew had been subjected to for those years as a training period, he said, no longer are you under that training period. He said, they were just a shadow of what was coming. The reality is in Jesus Christ. The substance is in Christ. It belongs to Him. And if you're in Christ, then it belongs to you. And your life then is a constant worship to God. We'll be discussing some of the implications of this for the next few weeks. But begin to grasp and to grapple with this concept. And watch how it begins to give real fervor and vitality to everything you do in life. Everything. Everything. Whatever you do in word or deed, do everything in the name of the Lord Jesus Christ, giving thanks to God the Father through Him. Oh boy, Christians are ushered into the realm of the reality as they begin to worship God on that plane of His existence that is characteristic of His nature. God is spirit, and your spirit communing with Him constitutes true worship. May God bless us as we continue these thoughts. Be thankful you're a Christian. Love the Lord Jesus Christ day and night. Fall in love with Him. Go to Him or through Him to the Father and spend constant time with Him, constant communion. Tonight, if you're not a Christian, we offer the opportunity for you to become one. Or if you are a Christian and you say, look, I want to talk about these things. Give me somebody to talk to. Well, come on, we'll just put somebody with you. One of the elders will be here. We've got 22 shepherds who are waiting to talk if you want to talk. Terry and me and then just hundreds of other older Christians here who will help. If you want to, you come on while we stand and sing.